This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? Alright, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
It goes. I need to be at the piano for this.
Do it. This is fun. Let's do this all day. That's it. See, already I'm swallowing a tear.
That one.
Coming up on this episode of White Wine Question Time.
I definitely felt it. You know, you're getting heartfelt messages of saying, people, you know, this is saving me every day. And I'm thinking, well, I've also got my own family and I've got my parents and, you know, and I've got my own sanity to take care of under those extraordinary conditions.
Were you a raver?
I mean, I was like 13 and I was at home. So oh, yeah. I was just raving quietly in the kitchen and thinking how very exciting and seeing pictures of, and, you know, and there was that moral panic around raving and I thought it sounded all terribly exciting.
I feel like I contributed to that during a long stint of hosting singing competitions in the early noughties. I apologise.
I mean, I didn't like to. I, do you know what? I deliberately skirted round the title of a well-known show because I knew you were involved. It's your fault.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over 3 glasses of wine. And my guest this week is a man who first came bounding onto our screens in 2006 with an infectious enthusiasm and determination to bring a love of choral singing to us all. He was working for the London Symphony Orchestra, running a youth choir, when the BBC discovered him via a Google search. They were looking for a choir master for a new show they were doing called The Choir and entrusted the job to him. It was an instant success and won a BAFTA, leading him to bring together choirs in a variety of settings and communities, be they a bunch of uninterested schoolboys, prisoners, or most famously, the military wives who he shared a Christmas number one with in 2011. Born in London and raised in Bournemouth, his mother was a civil servant, his father a bank manager, but they both loved Amdram. In fact, they met performing at a local Amdram society. A musical household, he fell in love with choirs at the age of 10 and studied drama at the University of East Anglia before doing a post-grad vocal studies course at the Royal Academy of Music. His plans for a career in music, though, stalled in his early 20s and he found himself landing a role as a youth worker, trying to introduce disadvantaged kids to classical music. They loved it, and to his great surprise, so did he. And it's a variation on that theme, inspiring others to sing and giving them the tools and the encouragement to do so, that has formed the backbone of his career ever since. He now lives in North London with his wife Becky, an English teacher, and their three children. And as well as his work as a choir master, he's also appeared on The Masked Dancer and MasterChef. Earlier this year, having proved his mettle when he orchestrated the choir for the Queen's Jubilee, he was called up again by the palace to participate in creating a choir for King Charles's coronation, which was documented in the BBC series Sing for the King. Now he's about to head back out on the road with his new show, Sing Along a Gareth 2, which is touring the UK. Can't wait. Let's dial him in, shall we? It's Gareth Malone. How are you?
I'm very well. Well, I enjoyed that very much. It was highly accurate. Not a single mistake. Yeah, nothing. All accurate. That was all very good. It's not always the case, you know.
Well, I know. Wikipedia is a cruel mistress, I've discovered.
Yes, fickle. Fickle, she is.
But Wikipedia, you struggle to get stuff taken down, I've discovered. But it's so easy to put stuff up. Somebody once put that I had a child that I'd conceived around the back of the local Quick Save in Cheltenham, Gloucestershire. Wasn't true, but it stayed there for a while, let me tell you.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Kind of liked
that's
it. Great.
I mean, I think you really know you've gone down the rabbit hole when you start editing your own Wikipedia. I think that's the beginning of the end, isn't it? So,
well,
you should
just
leave
that
one there.
Well, it only came to my attention
when
somebody interviewed me and asked how I was coping with parenting, and I'm like, I don't have any. That's what I mean about the cruel mistress. But you're back out on the road. I know today is a fraught day. I'm speaking to you the day before opening night. And as much as this is a Gareth sing-along a two, and you've done this once before, I would imagine that there is, apart from the title, very little that is the same.
Absolutely. The main structure of the show is the same. I walk out onto stage and I start singing a song and everybody sings along. And it's like that the whole night. We have a screen behind with the lyrics emblazoned in large friendly letters. And I just have a great time on stage. But it is, as you say, completely new songs. So I've spent the last sort of 2-3 months arranging and just trying to work out what it is that people want to sing at one of my shows. Because it might be a song that I like, but maybe the audience doesn't like it, or maybe it's a song that the audience like, but I don't want to sing it. So it's got to be thought carefully about.
I don't know what it is about you, Gareth, but you seem to coax a vocal out of the least likely. I'll give you an example, right? My father, I love dearly, and I've stood next to him in churches, at funerals, at weddings, at school plays, whatever. And he only ever mimes. I tell him and my mum that you're coming on the podcast. They're like, oh, put us down for tickets. Me and your father would love to go. Oh, and I said, Daddy, you sure? He's like, oh, yeah, I like him. You make even mutes sing.
Yes, I'm coaxing blood from the stone. I think we all have someone in our family who, you know, sings once a year at the carol service, and it's absolutely awful. And I think that's usually the main problem, is that people just don't do enough of it. I sing all the time. I sing every day, and I don't mind singing as well. You know, if you ask me to say, you know, how does happy birthday go? Happy birthday to you. Off I go. There's no moment where I think, oh, perhaps I shouldn't sing. And I definitely think that becomes, you know, it's quite easy to make that a culture in, you know, be it with my kids in the house or when I'm working on a series. I know, you know, a lot of crew members will start, and on day one they say, oh, well, you won't get me singing. And by the end of the programme, it's just become so normal. Everyone's just going, oh, what about that one that goes blah, and off they go, which I really like.
The inner Mariah comes out, doesn't it?
Inner Mariah, absolutely. The outer Mariah, becomes manifest. It's really, I think, a lovely thing to do, and we shouldn't be ashamed of it. And, I really blame recording for our kind of nervousness around singing, because I just think at one time anyone would have got up and done a song. And my dad's a Glaswegian, and it's very much in his culture to do a turn. So people would just get up and do a song. And, you know, they're not all blessed with brilliant voices, and they're a couple of whiskies down, maybe. But they do it anyway. And I think we've got into this place where it's only for the very, very talented to sing. And I think that's a shame.
Yeah. I feel like I contributed to that during a long stint of hosting singing competitions in the early noughties. I apologise.
I mean, I didn't like to. I deliberately skirted round the title of a well-known show because I knew you were involved. It's your fault. And kids would sing in, you know, you'd ask them to sing and they'd immediately saw themselves in an X Factor audition, which was strange, you know, working in singing, you know, you get kids turning up to choir, sort of ready to sing a song that's completely inappropriate for them, and you know, it's just what it is, and you know, it carries on now with The Voice, and I think a lot of young kids, that's their first point of thinking when they think about singing, and they don't think, oh, I could go in a choir. Honestly, my own son is nervous about singing on his own, you know, which you'd think I'd be able to sort that out, wouldn't you? But it's a big deal for young people. It's a big deal.
It is. You have cracked some hard nuts, though. And, you know, you're not a man that likes to make life easy for himself. So here we are, the day before your show opens, you're putting new numbers in, which requires huge amounts of thought, planning, organising. And then on top of that, you've decided to put AI into the heart of your show to make your life very difficult live every night. And I'm so intrigued to understand why you want to hurt yourself like this, but also how you came to the idea.
Well, it was a discussion with one of my singers, Laurel, and we were laughing about AI, and I don't know, it just came up on, and I thought actually that could be really fun. It's one of my favourite bits of the show is we make up a song with the audience, so wherever we are, and we've had some really funny ones. You know, they're always very silly. You know, we were in London and we sang about the angels over, you know, they have the lights on Oxford Street, and we made a kind of Christmas carol Oxford about Street. That one year, and we did a song about Isambard Kingdom Brunel, you know, just random stuff, roundabouts.
So it's always about local kind of sites, or...
It could be like, it's usually, you know, Milton Keynes is famous for its roundabouts, and I forget where it was, I think it might have been Wolverhampton, where it was about the fact that it was the first ever traffic light, which sounds like unpromising, but we made it into this kind of hymn, this anthem, this glorious gospel kind of, you know, we're all doing sidesteps and clicks to the joy that is a traffic light, and everyone just sort of gets massively behind it, and then we have everyone doing actions. So you've just got people who, you know, I don't know, they're bank managers or insurance brokers by day, and they're all kind of doing actions like it's primary school. But it's a lot of fun. But the hardest bit of that, we go in and we never have a plan. We never, ever have a plan. We just walk in and we go, right, what are we making a song about tonight? And we all get a kind of sense of excitement because there's nothing. And then suddenly, 7 or 8 minutes later, we've got a little song. You know, not a hit record, but we've got a song. And I thought actually it might be quicker and more fun to do it with AI. And as I started doing it, I've tried a few different ones. I've tried Google Bard, but the best one is ChatGPT. And you can say, you know, make me a song. And you can then say, you know, make it about Kate Thornton's fringe, which I know you've recently trimmed.
Thanks.
You were telling
I'd
me
love
before.
That.
So we could do that, and then we could say, but make it in the style of Bob Marley. And it suddenly gets a kind of little, it gives you these lyrics that have, I don't know, you know, sunshine and little references. It's incredible. So it's just a bit of fun. But you know, my mum especially, genuinely frightened. And I know, you know, Elon Musk is coming, I think it's today, and with the head of ChatGPT to discuss
Park.
The future of... Yeah, it's a huge thing, and I think it's going to be part of our lives. So I just thought it was nice to engage
already
with
is.
It.
We just don't realise how much.
It's underpinning so much. And I, you know, I think pretty soon we'll have these, you know, our personal HomePod things that are in the kitchen, and they'll be listening, and we'll be able to chat to them, which is kind of an amazing thought. It's like being in Star Trek. Anyway, all of that is by the by, because musicians are always, we always love a bit of technology. You can see I'm in a studio. I love anything with buttons and beeps. I'm really into. And I think, you know, there are responsible ways to use any tool. So hopefully people will just find it amusing. And some of the suggestions will be hilarious, I think.
I think, though, we are of a generation that grew up, you know, with the digital revolution. You know, I remember being at school, being kind of having my mind blown by the fact that you could write boobs upside down on a calculator. And that seemed revolutionary. That was in my living memory.
Listen,
and
now look where we are. I'm still getting over that.
But in lockdown, you really went, you went for it, didn't you? I think it was beautifully described in one newspaper as you did for the larynx what Joe Wicks did for the lunge in lockdown. And you assembled 11,000 people to perform as the Great British Home Chorus, featuring the London Symphony Orchestra. I mean, the tech meltdowns you must have had trying to make that happen. I hope that your swear box runneth over.
Oh, it really did. It was absolutely hilarious. I think Joe was slightly ahead of me because he was already doing quite a lot of online workouts. So he had all the kit. I had the idea about 2 weeks before lockdown because I'd been in Germany. So I got the kit kind of shipped in, but I had to discover how to use it. And I was using my own computer, and the computer, it was my old computer, and it wasn't, you know, wasn't pacey enough, and it kept stuttering. Yeah. And then there was one night I just thought, oh, I'll just move it ever so slightly. And I shifted it slightly to the left and the power came out, and my live stream to, you know, oh, I can't remember, like 40,000 people or something, just went dead immediately. So yeah, it was that side of it was a nightmare. It was great to be able to feel like I was making a difference, and the messages were incredible. But I really missed that, you know, because music is so much for me about people in a space and the communication between them. That's kind of the best thing. It's about, no one goes home and goes, oh, do you know what? That, you know, that concert I went to, they played technically brilliantly. It was marvellous. Every note was exactly in place. It's not the thing you remember. You remember, oh, it was so moving when he talked about this, and then they did the song that made me cry. That's what music is about. It's about people and heart and emotion. And it went, you know, tech can just, it can be enabling, but it can also just massively get in the way, which is why I like this, you know, this live show, because I'm just there with my crowd, and it's very instant. And even if the, you know, everything goes wrong, I've got an acoustic guitar, I can sit on the front of the stage and I can get everyone singing, and that feels sort of very kind of old fashioned, and like an old pub knees up. But yeah, the
busker with bells
very
on
nearly finished me. Yeah, busker with bells on. But I feel for Joe Wicks, because I think the responsibility that he suddenly felt, because I think where he was ahead in the tech, I was ahead in terms of I'd been in the public eye for quite a long time, and I'd just sort of been around the block a bit. I'm a little bit older than him, and I remember watching him thinking, this is too much for one person to shoulder, you know, that sort of responsibility. And I definitely felt it. You know, you're getting heartfelt messages of saying, you know, this is saving me every day. And I'm thinking, well, I've also got my own family, and I've got my parents, and, you know, and I've got my own sanity to take care of under those extraordinary conditions. And I kind of watched him manically holding us all together. And it didn't surprise me when I watched, I don't know if you watched his documentary that he made after about the whole process. And I think he'd really struggled with it. It was a very, very big thing he took on.
Well, I think as the whole world went into lockdown, he became he became the UK's PE teacher, and you became head of music.
That's right.
It's a lot to carry on your shoulders.
Yeah. It was. I sort of drew a line under it eventually, because I thought, actually, people want to, you know, I know that it's a great tool, and I've done, even for this tour, I've been rehearsing, because there's a choir in each venue. I've done some online rehearsals. It's a great tool for doing that kind of thing, but it's a facsimile of the real thing. You know, being in a room, there's nothing to beat it. And, you know, I had rehearsals yesterday, and it's the little looks that pass between you when you go, oh, it's this bit, you know, oh, this, I love this chorus, this is the one with the drop, this is the one with the funky rhythm, this is, you know, or somebody sings really sweetly. Those are the things that make me, well, those are the things that I really missed. I realised how much I couldn't just be a solitary musician. I'm not someone, you know, one of these sort of concert pianists, or certainly not that, who sits on their own and just plays incredible pieces of music by themselves. I need other musicians, or it's not music for me.
It all takes me very nicely to my first question for you. Are you ready to dive in?
Right, fire away.
Whilst you're kind of percolating all of the numbers that you're going to take out on the road. Obviously, the set list that you're putting together is there to derive as much joy from the room as possible. But if you were allowed to indulge yourself and stitch together a set list or a soundtrack that scored you and your life, the songs that really give you joy, what would they be? And what are the moments of happiness that sit behind them?
That's a good question. I think it would make no sense to the casual listener because it's just little bits of music that mean something to me for obscure reasons. You know, there's I immediately start to think about like Bach, which was how I got into choirs, but and certain passages within certain pieces that I performed, and memories like little kind of, I don't know, memories of singing something and a shaft of light coming through the cathedral window, those sorts of things that are very personal.
Cinematic moments.
Yeah, really. Music can be so evocative and so emotional. Now, when I then go back and listen to that piece, I'm transported back. It's like smelling something. It's very kind of instant. I guess there's a lot of those, and there's bits of classical music that my mum brought me up on, like Vivaldi and lots of opera that she used to play. But I think that the music that really has been there through my whole life is definitely the Beatles, because I think when I was born, it was 75, and I remember the news that John Lennon had been shot being on the radio when I was just coming up to five, I think, in 1980, or maybe just after my fifth birthday. And I remember how upset my parents were. And so I think that he'd always played the Beatles, but I think that re-energized his interest in them. And so he played it all through my childhood. Sgt. Pepper, we had Sgt. Pepper, which we wore out. And then we got CDs, we got them all on CD. And I suddenly got this new excitement hearing all that detail and listening on we had a new stereo that was really kind of clear and had fantastic bass. And
not a stacker system anymore.
No, it was a little bit. Yeah, because when I was a kid, it was one of those all in one. It had a tape player and it was all sort of flat, you know, and it had a record player, and it would, you know, it had the auto thing. You press start and it would all kind of come up and miss the record and crackle and skid. And it had a radio as well. You could get long wave, and it said, you know, like Abu Dhabi, just places, you know.
It seemed really exotic, didn't it?
It did, yeah. It was like radio sessions that you'd listen to for 20 seconds and then hear some distant voice. And that sound of the crackly long wave radio is so kind of evocative of something, so it's like exotic. Sound world, but
sounds odd to young people now. Like if you explain that to your kids, they just think you're odd, because there's no way that they can imagine a world where you couldn't speak to somebody anywhere at any time, because we are a hyper connected world. But to listen
strange,
to something from another country, you know, like I remember not even being able to phone home much when I was abroad because it was so expensive. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
When I first started work, and I'd phone my mum and dad to go, I've landed. Yeah, I'm fine. I'm in New York. I'll call you when I get back. Bye.
Insert more money. Yeah, absolutely. And that sense, I think not only that in communication terms we've expanded, but culturally we've expanded. And I remember when I was a kid, there was like some... something like the sound of the Incas, and it had the pan pipes, and I remember it being really popular in the early 80s, and my parents got the record, and it was just like, wow, the sound of the music from Peru, and we have it here on a record, this is unbelievable. Well, now it's just like, that's nothing. But I almost feel that's a shame, because I savoured that. I connected with that, and the exoticism and the excitement of that. And now it's sort of, my kids would just listen to it and go, I don't like pan pipes. That'd be it. You know? So it's hard to get kids to feel special about stuff.
What else was the music, you know, can you name some of the other songs that stretched your imagination that have stayed with you in terms of the way they made you feel?
I sort of went through various versions of myself, I suppose, that were very wrapped up in music when I was a teenager, as we all do. I experimented with, you know, dance music, you know, things like KLF, EMF. I'm really aging myself now. And that kind of craze for acid house and all of those things. I sort of flirted with that.
Were you a raver?
I mean, I was like 13 and I was at home. So I was just raving quietly in the kitchen and thinking how very exciting and seeing pictures of, and, you know, and there was that moral panic around raving and I thought it sounded all terribly exciting. And then I got into guitars and like Pink Floyd and Led Zeppelin. I still do find Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd very, like that's an amazing beautiful. Piece of work. Really, really beautiful
Isn't
piece
it?
Of work. And very emotive and really really interesting.
I listened to it about 3 weeks ago and I really, it took me back to exactly that moment in time when I first discovered it. As a teenager.
There are few records like that, and that is one of those. My girlfriend's mother had the double sleeve, and it had all the artwork. And she lent it to me, said, "Oh, listen, I think you'll really like this." And I remember putting it on, and you know, there's that slide guitar into the first drop of the album, and there's all the talking beforehand. Oh, and it kind of blossoms, and. I remember I was in the dining room. I sort of put it in. We had our record player in the sitting room, and I'd just gone through to get something, and I just remember hearing the sound, kind of running in, and then just starting it again. Yeah, it's great, and that music, I suppose, because it was lyrically interesting, it was musically interesting. I suppose that's where my interest in pop, like pure pop, started to wane a bit. You know, the Kylie Minogue records didn't hold the same allure that they had when I was, you know, 13, 14.
Yeah. I think sometimes, though, that you need a gateway record, and Floyd and Stevie Wonder were definitely gateway artists for me. And it was only when... So, I mean, I grew up loving George Michael, right? Massive George Michael fan. And then when he started to cover certain artists, I'd go and listen to the originals. And sometimes you need somebody to take you by the hand into the music of the past so you can discover the glory of it. But that sense of revelation with things like Dark Side of the Moon, just how it sounded. We'd all used to go and sit in this guy's mum and dad's basement, right, and turn all the lights off because it sounded really trippy. And then we'd listen to it and go, oh my God, this is amazing, right? But you would, can you imagine a piece of music doing that to you now where you'd all take your friends downstairs and sit in the dark listening to it because it gave you a heightened experience? I mean, most people take drugs for that.
Yeah, I was thinking about this yesterday that you know, the idea of an album, the idea of a song, the idea of a release date being something kind of really sacred and special, and you know, the pilgrimage of the record shop. I'm really sounding old today, God, but it was like you'd go to our price and you would, you know, and you'd saved all the money, and there's something in that. You would just cherish the object and cherish the musical experience. And I don't think kids have the same thing. I don't think music means
the
same thing.
You can't, because now you can hear something and Shazam it. You can download it immediately. We used to have to save our money, get the bus into town on a Saturday, then take the record home before you could play it. You would stare at the record before you played the record, and you would read the liner notes and...
It was a holy experience.
It was religious.
And that's not to say that music doesn't mean anything to young people, because it does. But I think it is just more, it's just so much more available. I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see what becomes of the popular form. I think is shifting. You know, we know now that like the effect of Spotify algorithms has reduced the length of songs. You know, people are making songs that are 2 minutes, 30 seconds. It's almost gone back to what pop songs were like in the 50s. And that's interesting to me, that the actual sort of the technology and the medium changes the experience.
Yeah, but then once in a while, you'll get somebody that will come along and remind you of the importance of that kind of the group excitement of a release date. Or Taylor Swift. Taylor Swift is my case in point. I just think she's the most remarkable artist. And she applies a lot of those old school practices to a very new modern world in which she reigns supreme. And I love that. I love that people get excited about her re-recording her original work. I also love that she's brought it back and gone screw you to the guys that did her over. You know, there's a lot to her.
Yeah, yeah. That's. I think she's somebody who just has. She's got the whole package, hasn't she? You know, she can sing, she can write, she can, and she's her own woman. So she's a great role model. She's definitely someone
she's a great
who
CEO. You know,
we'll have on in the kitchen, and not worry about the impact it's going to have on our daughters. Or sons, for that matter.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the others? Well, as we move through into your early adult life, as you start to try to pique young minds with your love of classical music, what was the stuff that was actually piquing your own interests at that time, Gareth?
I think that when I went to university and I suddenly found myself sort of like hugely challenged, you know, I was studying drama and literature, and I was being exposed to all sorts of different time periods. You know, we were studying Greek drama and European 19th century drama, all sorts of things like that. So I think I felt like it was really important to get my head out of the narrow band of music that I've been listening to. And I had always loved classical music, but I think I had quite a sort of classic FM, you know, I knew some Vivaldi, I knew some this. I'd done my A-level music pieces, and I just wanted to kind of just listen to anything and see if I could find value in it. And I went to, and it was record shops again, I just went and I bought Shostakovich CDs and Mahler CDs and these sort of big symphonies, and I found them really hard to access, and I just put them on. I'd think, I've spent £8 on this, I'm going to give it another go. And I just sort of keep them on until I always found that there was a moment where I went, oh, I love that bit. I love that bar. And then you go, oh, actually, well, I'll put it on because I've got the anticipation of that little, that unlocking moment. I mean, you said that gateway, you know, I think we all need hooks into whatever it might be. And I think in popular music, there's like hooks. They're just trying to grab, it's like an advert, you know, it's like someone trying to sell you washing powder. They're just sort of, pop music is very desperate for your attention, whereas classical music, it sits back a bit and goes, well, this is it. You know, it just serves it up on a little platter and says, there you go, and you've got to find your way in. So I think when I'm, you know, when I've spent years like introducing people to music in of all sorts, and I'm always trying to find what it is that is like that anyone can hear. You know, nothing sort of too highfalutin, but something that, like a story that connects you in. You go, well, you know, the reason that this piece is great is because when the composer wrote it, they were in the middle of a divorce or, some great drama in their life. And I think that helps you to understand it in human terms, because I think, especially with classical music, it can sound rather too perfect, like almost, especially with choirs.
Yeah.
It sounds sort of celestial. Yeah. You can't imagine what possibly made Thomas Tallis want to write this piece?
Yeah, I remember as a teenager, I don't know where I stumbled upon this, and it was on vinyl. There was a piece of classical music. I think it's called Moonlight Sonata. Would that be right? Midnight Sonata, Moonlight Sonata.
Moonlight Sonata, Beethoven, yeah. Was it this one? I'll play it on the real piano. That's what I'll do.
Yeah,
this one.
Go on, do it. Yeah.
It goes, I can't remember what key it's in. Is it C-sharp minor? Oh.
That's it.
That one?
That's beautiful, yeah.
Something like that.
That's a musical hug right there.
You know what that reminds me of? Greats.
When you talk about transportive moments, so that was when I think I was probably grappling with my hormones as a teenager, thinking the world didn't understand me and I had all these plans for myself. And yeah. I used to lie on my single bed in my very tiny bedroom with that just playing over and over, thinking, I've got to have a plan. And that's what soundtracks that for me. And every time, and now in my adult life, when I hit a wall, I go to that piece of music. It's like it sits in my musical medicine cabinet.
Yeah, I have a lot of pieces like that, and I'm always interested to know what people's are. I had a friend at university whose mother died, and while she was very young, and she listened to this piece by Goretzky. It's so dark. It's about the Holocaust, and it's just the most I'm not selling it here, but it's the most beautiful, beautiful piece of music. And she would do exactly. She knew in herself when she needed a good weep, and she'd kind of put that on, and that would be the piece that would just kind of help her to release. And for me, Barber's Adagio, which is the piece that's in it. I think it's Platoon. It's a very, very famous piece.
Yes.
That's. That, you, do you know the one I mean? It goes. I need to be at the piano for this.
Do it. This is fun. Let's do this all day. That's it. See, already I'm swallowing a tear.
That one. It's so good. And that's one of my pieces. And I think I discovered in my 20s that I liked music that took you to those places, you know, that really, I think when you're a teenager, music is, yes, it's about identity. It probably is about emotion to a degree as well. But, you know, you're young and you're just sort of exploring the limits of your emotional landscape, aren't you? And I was sort of hungry to experience life and hungry to experience feeling. And I found that music for me just like, just got me right in the heart. And I felt like I was just, I don't know, so I was like I was on some kind of, some journey without leaving my room.
Yeah, but it's funny, isn't it? Because classical music, what I love about it is that there are no lyrics because I lean into words. I'm very literal. So classical music is something I've returned to recently. In sort of midlife, right, having these kind of, you know, mad perimenopausal moments where my son's come downstairs in summer and had all the doors open. I was blaring classical music. And he said, "Mum, are you all right?" And I said, "Yeah, it just helps me think." Mm. When you take the words away, no one's telling me what to think. I think for myself. And he's like, "Oh, yeah." I thought, oh, my God, that's probably one of the greatest lessons I could teach him about how to consume music. Go and find something that makes that affords you the opportunity to think.
Yeah, and feel as well. And it will mean something completely personal to you that no one will ever really understand. And yet, at the same time, we both connect to those pieces of music. You know, you don't know what my associations are and I don't know what yours are, but there's a raw power. And isn't that incredible that, you know, someone sitting in, about 100 years ago in America wrote this piece of music and I can just play a couple of notes on the piano and you have an emotional response. I mean, that's an awesome, magical power. You know, people often ask me, in 2-minute radio interviews when I'm promoting, they'll say, "So what is the power of music? Where do I even start?" I've no idea. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it is that somebody can encode a bit of their soul in, it's like Harry Potter, isn't it? Splitting, you know, Voldemort splitting themselves. It's like you're shaving off a bit of their soul and putting it into this music, and we can feel it 200, 300 years later. I mean, it's absolutely magical. And I kind of just don't want to know why that is. I don't think we'll ever quite be able to reduce it to a pithy sentence, other than saying it's mystical or it's magical. I think it's a beautiful thing, and it doesn't matter how clever we get as a species and how wonderful our technology is. I feel like we're always going to need that. Like, that is something that is for us. It's a gift for us as a species that we've needed since we were like cave people, and we will need in 2,000 years. We're still going to need culture. It will move on, and it will change shape and colour and texture, but it will still be the experience of communicating through voice and through instruments.
Well, you think about it, the two pieces of music you've just turned to play are hundreds of years old. So that proves your point entirely, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Love
yeah,
that.
It does.
Could talk about music all day.
I'm obsessed with music. And I don't think that, you know, you could write a piece today, or you can look at a piece that's 300 years old, and I just don't think it matters where it comes from. if you have a little hook into it and you can understand what it's about and if it has an emotional effect on you, then it's good in my book.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Sadly, we have to leave music for now to jump into my next question because I have to release you because you have a show to open tomorrow night.
I do, yeah.
So here we go, question number two. Life is so often what happens when you're busy making plans elsewhere, and I think that was certainly true for you when you're in your early 20s, kind of lacking direction in terms of where to go next. When a family friend called to encourage you to apply for a job they'd seen for a youth worker, specifically a youth worker who would introduce classical music to disadvantaged kids. And it was kind of never where you planned to be, but ultimately it led you to your dream career. It got you to where you wanted to be, but there was a severe detour. When else have you had to reroute in life to get to ultimately where you needed to be?
I mean, I think my career has been a series of wandering paths, and I've just always followed my nose through them. You know, I think when a crossroads comes or a fork in the road, you have to pick one, and I've never been afraid of making those decisions and just running with it. I think that when I finished studying, so after that, I then decided I was going to go and study classical singing at the Royal Academy of Music, and probably thinking about being a proper classical, grown-up classical singer, not really sure. And then when I finished the 2 years, I thought, I'm not sure that's quite right for me. You know, there were other people who were doing it who I felt like, oh yeah, you're definitely going to do that. and then out of the sky dropped this this television series, The Choir, and I'd had an interest in television, and I was thinking, you know, presenting and talking, broadcasting, and so I kind of leapt at it. But it did take me away from music weirdly, because I was making a program about music, but actually in terms of, like, so for me, like, solid musical content, you know, playing, time to practice, time to work with great musicians and all the rest of it, there wasn't very much of that. And I loved the outward feeling of going, right, come on, kids, you know, Lewis and Imran and all these boys that I was working with and trying to get them in. I loved that. It was very much like flowing out of me into them, trying to get their interest. And I thought, there's nothing going the other way. So I made a decision around 2010 when my daughter was born that I was going to turn the ship and start to do more music myself. So recording, doing albums and live music, and it's taken me, I'd say, about 12 to 13 years to really get to grips with that.
But isn't that good though, in so many ways, that it's something that was that hard fought?
Yeah, it's been like a burning ambition to be to kind of find things that did all of it for me. So the playing, the presenting, the arranging, the writing, like all of it. And that's, I feel like very lucky that here I am. I'm about to be 48 this year. And to get to this point in my life and think, actually, there's not, you know, there's not a month that goes by where I'm not doing doing all of the things that I really enjoy. But that, yeah, that was hard for. And I think you've got to, I think with music, it has to be like that. It has to be a kind of absolutely burning passion, you know. And when I was taken away from it and focused so much on television and making, you know, what television's like, it's really, you know, super absorbing, really hard work, you know, out on the road, stupid hours in hotel rooms with no instruments, months on end, all of that, I just was like getting really itchy feet all the time. I just wanted to get back to a piano. I wanted to do something of my own. And I think you ask any musician, you know, could you do something else? And they will say, no, I absolutely couldn't. I couldn't. I would go crazy if I didn't have music on a regular basis. I think I would just be, I would not be happy, put it that way.
So it's like a family member to you. It's something you can't live without.
Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, you know the song, Music Was My First Love and It Will Be My Last. We're doing a section from that in a medley on my tour at the end. And I was playing the whole thing to my wife and we got to that bit and she went, yeah, that's you. as if to say, you know, what about me? What am I, chopped liver? But it's not like that. It's not like a love relationship. It's just it's a passion. It's an interest. And music just enhances everything else. You put music on, you know, sat at breakfast and put the radio on and suddenly, like, life means something. It just adds colour. It does. Like putting the lights on in a darkened room, it's wonderful. Never get bored of it.
Your wife, it's funny that she kind of rolls her eyes in those moments. But it sounds like you're never, ever in danger of not keeping your feet on the ground with her around or her mother. In fact, your mother-in-law's referred to you as a young fogey. And your wife described her decision to start dating you as like taking him on as a project.
Yeah, that sounds right. Did she say that? Yeah, she probably did. Yeah, I think that's probably accurate. Young fogey is right. It's funny how I think this is where other people's associations with music forms start to come in, because I think when you are a musician, all I care about is the music. I don't care about the marketing of it. I don't care that he looked really cool on the sleeve. Like, just not interested. Absolutely, I pay no attention to that. But I think other people really do, especially if they're not a musician. So if I'm listening to Bach, well, then I must somehow be like interested in things that are 300 years old, or you know. Yeah, and therefore a fogey. Whereas actually, to me, all of that music is incredibly alive, and it's like fresh and exciting, as fresh and exciting as Taylor Swift might be to somebody else. So, I suppose that's where the fogey comes from. I am interested in, you know, I do. Yeah, I'm not quite ready for pipe and slippers, but I do like old things.
In terms of your relationship with your wife, how did you two come to be, and is it something that you had to kind of go around the houses to get to?
No, it was another. I mean, I've been very lucky. I just met her one night and was like, "Oh, well, that's that. Off we go." I mean, it was really like real kind of just instant, really. So no, I didn't have to. You know, there wasn't some great kind of, I don't know, decision to be made there. It was just sort of really obvious. I suppose there were things that I was, you know, I checked that she could sing. That was obviously really important. Yeah. I mean, can you imagine if you're musical and being married to someone? You know, people say, oh, my husband, terrible singer. And I say, oh, I couldn't. I don't know what I'd do. No, she sings really well. She's very in tune. And
is that like one of your rules of dating?
If there were a Gareth Malone rules of dating, it would a love for music, a love of culture and an interest in, you know, a wide-ranging, non-judgmental interest in culture, I think, was really important. If she'd been one of those people who I'd said, oh, I like, you know, who you are, say, what kind of music are you into? And you list one person, they go, oh, I don't like them. If she'd been like that, then it would have been a no. But she's not. She's very open minded about music. And I mean, the poor woman. I took her to all sorts of classical concerts. And you know, we were in our 20s, and I was like experimenting with all sorts of things, and took her to some very long operas, and she had to endure all of that. I remember one very, very loud performance where the trumpets were blaring, and we were right near the front. She was just sort of sitting there subtly trying to put her fingers in her ears without the orchestra seeing.
She must really love you, Gareth.
Yeah, she's definitely, yeah, she did that for me. Not doesn't do that anymore.
Yeah, well, you know, that's the charm of a long-term relationship, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Time for my third and final question for you. Fate, Lady Luck, right time, right place, call it what you like. Your entry into the world of television came about as the result of a simple Google search, right? Mm. If that algorithm had not spurted back your name when the BBC entered their search credentials for a choir master, who knows what might have happened? So is that, I mean, obviously that is a significant sliding doors moment, but when else has that been the case for you where fate has intervened and taken you somewhere that you hadn't planned to be?
That's a good question. Can you hear the cogs? The cogs are whirring.
Yeah.
I suppose a big change in my life was that my parents moved to Bournemouth when I was 10. And we were in South London. I was very much, like, considered myself to be a London kid. And with every, you know, like, a city dweller. And that has a kind of energy about it, a different energy from a country mouse. And I suddenly found myself, I remember being in Sainsbury's when I was about 10 in Bournemouth at the Hampshire Centre, if anyone remembers that place, it's no longer with us. And the shop assistant said, oh, hello, how are you? And my mother and I looked at each other like, what's she doing? Why is she speaking to us? This is very odd. And this that whole change of pace of life from the frantic, kind of slightly edgy experience of growing up in London to the beach, the forest, and also music. There were so many choirs. The school that I went to had this incredible choir director, Stephen Carlson, who's my music teacher. And had it not been for that, I mean, actually the biggest change was that it was a grammar school that I went to, and I came from outside the system. All the kids in that local area were kind of like crammed to get them into the grammar school. You know, they all did their like 11 plus very diligently, and I hadn't really done any of that preparation. I did a bit, but not very much. And I think I probably just scraped through. And had that not happened, and had I not had that music teacher, I don't know if music would be so important. But he gave me the chance to see music in a very fluid way. He played jazz. He would kids would bring in their pop records to Pow. I remember my mate bringing in. China in Your Hand. Great, really, really beautiful song. And he put it on in the class, and we all listened to it. And he said, "Oh, you know what's interesting about this?" And he found some little lesson that he was able to give to the class based on that. He was a very kind of improvisatory teacher. And then I'd be playing in the band, and I'd be doing this, and then singing in the choir, obviously, and all under his tutelage. And I think that has that way of thinking about music has carried me through. We don't need to see. There's enough barriers and divisions in the world without letting music be something that adds to that. Just be something that you can enjoy no matter what as long as it's good. That's Duke Ellington, isn't it? There are two types of music, good music and bad music. And I really do feel that. I don't care what it, you know, it can be from Guatemala and in a language I've never heard of. And if it's got a kind of energy and something interesting about it, then I will listen to it.
Yeah, it's good sometimes to keep jumping around on the stuff that you do put on your playlists. I started, what did I downloaded the other day? Ladysmith, Black
Mambazo, yeah.
Mambazo, yeah. And I heard it somewhere and I thought, God, yeah, I love them. And actually, downloaded loads of their music, put them on multiple playlists, so it just kind of comes up and shuffles. But God, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, I mean, the raw power of their singing is so fabulous. And they were, I think I'm right in saying, the musicians who worked with Paul Simon on Graceland, which is one of my all-time favourite albums.
So that's
albums.
How they came... Gateways.
Yeah, that's the gateway for gateway. All of us with that music. And I grew up listening to that album, loved that sound world, that kind of very kind of spiritual but quite raw, edgy way of singing that they have. And then a few years ago, I worked with a musician who's passed away, a trumpeter sort of from South Africa called Hugh Masekela, when I was at LSO. And that was an incredible experience of working with one of those sort of like founding fathers of like music that was anti-apartheid. And he was amazing. He just had he was somebody who appreciated that sound, understood that world, and watching him, like the way he moved, the way he danced, the way his sort of rhythmic language was so instinctual and so South African. And I that was a real eye opener for me, and just into, you know, coming from a kind of quite potentially quite staid choral, you know, British sensibility to encounter musicians like that. And he brought over his team of South African musicians, and they were just like, it was just like music just was oozing out of them, and there was an effortlessness about that, and a confidence and a freedom that was just so enchanting. And I took a lot from that experience, because, you know, groups like that, they're not just, you know, like Ladysmith, Black Mambazo and Hugh Masekela, they're not just making music because they like making music. There's a political dimension to it. There's a reason. There's a passion. There's a struggle in the music. And I think that's why we all go, you know, we know the story, so that helps. But we also just, like, even if we don't know the story, we can hear the like heartfelt resonance of it. I think that's something that I always try to emulate with all my projects. You know, when I come to work with Military Wives, for example, you know, it's kind of going, well, what is it about you and your struggle, and how do we turn that into a sound? How do we make you sing like that? How do we make you find that heart and that connection, the guts to make that sound?
That's really interesting, because that's you drilling into their emotional beds, isn't it? What is it?
Yeah, that comes first.
Keeping you awake at night. What is it that makes you extremely emotional? And let's narrate that.
I think that is the way all artists work. You know, they're trying to hook into like the subconscious world. You know, what's making me? What is this melting pot of emotion that I've got, and how do I get that across to you through music? And I think, you know, if you are someone like Military Wives, for example, who felt that they had no voice and they weren't being heard, it's beyond just standing up and doing a speech. It's about kind of them feeling like, this is the way that I can pour my heart out, and people will understand me. And at the end, you know, we proved it. It definitely works, because people was. I remember Chris Evans reading out a tweet when I was on air with him, and somebody saying, I've had to pull over at the side of the road listening to these women sing, because it's just making me cry so much. Because we understood their plight, and they had this sort of rather celestial. We found this way of singing that just it touched people, I think.
When you talk about choirs, right, what we grew up with as choirs was very Middle England, I guess.
Yeah.
But then when did you start to dip your toe into other kinds of choirs? For example, church. I mean, when you look at Pentecostal churches, that is not a choir that I knew, but that was a choir I would love to have been a part of, because that wasn't right. Just singing, that was singing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I encountered the sound of the gospel church through like Michael Jackson, Andre Crouch, that Man in the Mirror. That I think that was my first introduction to that sound world, and I associated it actually not with gospel but with pop in a way, and it's only sort of recently that I've been a judge on like Gospel Choir of the Year and things like that on TV, and that it's just so exciting that because they have everything, they have all of that, they have the passion, the commitment, they're not doing it for the audience, they're doing it for God, and it has that just absolute spine tingling quality. And you know, some of the tunes are absolutely great and it's rhythmical and it's absolutely wonderful. And you're right, when I was a kid, the idea of choir, it was certainly within my culture, was it was some little old lady singing in the church, and it would and there'd be like 40 of them and there'd be two men. and it was not a thing that teenage boys went and did. And I was very lucky that somebody asked me to do it, and my music teacher said, oh, you should go and do that. And I just sort of fell in love with the music. And I think it's only really in the last sort of 30 years that the idea of community choirs, of choirs that are for a different purpose, they're not just for singing Handel and Haydn and Mozart, but you can sing an Adele song, you can do, you don't need to be brilliant, you don't need to be auditioned, you can just enjoy the social experience of it. Those sorts of choirs have really come to the fore, workplace choirs. And I think I've been a big part in bringing that to people's attention, which I'm really pleased about. And I wish there'd been someone who'd shown me that potential when I was, 13 or 14.
Well, let me tell you, your work lives on even when you step away from a choir. They continue without you. Last week I hosted an award show. It's one I've done for the last 3 years, and every year the same choir come back. They're called the City Choir. They work for Citibank. And yeah, I don't know how many years ago you put them together, but they are still going strong. 10.
Yeah, I just went to their anniversary concert the other week, and it was amazing to see some of the same faces in those series 10 years later, but they have learned so much. And I went to the anniversary concert, and they were saying to me, what's been amazing actually is that me and this singer next to me are now best friends, and we have been, and we would never have met had we not been in a choir. Yeah. And that's really special, because it's they needed the music to kind of like oil the wheels of friendship. Mm-hmm. And now it adds so much. Why am I going to choir? Well, I'm going to sing, but also I'm going to go and see my friend, and then we're going to sing this great music, and we're going to have a laugh, and it's going to go wrong, and it's going to, and then we're going to do a concert, and we're going to be backstage and have a glass of wine afterwards. All of that, that's the stuff that makes it so special.
And that's the stuff that you've sparked. You are England's choir master. And if people want to come along and experience it for themselves, the tour opens on tomorrow, 2nd of November. You're touring all over the UK. And this isn't just a sit up and watch show. This is a come along and get involved show. You sing along with you, and as well as creating a show, a moment out of AI, that could be about even roundabouts or local landmarks, is an opportunity for you just to go and raise your voice, isn't it?
It is. We've got everything from Elton John to Lady Gaga, The Beatles, Tina Turner, all sorts of bangers. Harry Styles.
Which Harry Styles are you doing?
We're doing Holding Me Back, Gravity's Holding Me Back, As It Was.
As It Was. What a great record.
It's a really good record, yeah.
Enjoy the tour. Thank you for making the time in an incredibly busy schedule. It's hugely appreciated. And my mum and dad will see you in Cheltenham on the 8th of December in fine voice.
Tell them to wave vigorously.
my huge thanks to Gareth. I do hope that's encouraged you to go and raise your voice with him on his tour. And for more conversations with other great musical types, our back catalogue is heaving with episodes with the likes of Gary Barlow, Jack Severetti, Tom Grennan, Ray, Ella Henderson, Matt Goss, Luke Evans, Michael Ball and Alfie Bowes, Charlene Spiteri, Ella Jones, Danny Minogue, Travis, I've run out of breath, but not out of guests. I'll be back on your feeds on Tuesday with more vintage cuts from the cellar and a brand new guest next Friday. Thanks so much, as always, for your company.
White Wine Question Time is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.